Today we're going to work in the homogeneous sublet space LLP. The case of the homogeneous sublet space is similar. In fact, it's an easy consequence of what I'm about to say about the homogeneous case. Okay. So, again, we only know how to treat the case p greater than n. By the way, we is Arya, Kevin, and me. These are theorems due to us. So, let's see. Remember the convention that constants denoted c always depend only on which function space we're working in. So in this case, on M and P. All right, so let me just review basic definitions and then state the main theorem and then get into the ideas of the proof. So today, E is going to be a finite set in Rn. And so LMP of E is going to consist of all real value functions on F. But the interesting thing is the semi-norm, or the norm, let's say, of F in LMP. And it's the inf of the LMP semi-norm of all possible extensions. Okay. A linear extension operator for E is what you think. It's a map from functions on E to functions on Rn. So that TF is always in LMP, and TF agrees with F on E. That's an extension operator. Okay. A set of assists for E, remember, is a set of linear functionals acting on LMP of E, with each of the functionals omega given by the formula that you see, just a sum of the values of F at the various points of E, multiplied by coefficients. But the good thing is that the total number of non-zero coefficients summed over all the functions omega 1 to omega S is at most a constant times N, where N is the number of points of E. And that means we can evaluate all of the omega s on a given f very quickly in linear time. Okay. Now suppose we have a set of assists. Some other linear function c is called omega-assisted mountain depth, or ABD, if it can be written as a linear combination of function values of f with coefficients mu, as on the slide, plus a linear combination of the assists, omega s of f, with coefficients lambda s, as in the slide. Of course, the mu's and lambda's are supposed to be independent of f, and furthermore, at most c of the mu's and at most c of the lambda's are non-zero, so that c is given by a real short formula, provided that we've already evaluated the omegas. Okay, similarly, if you have an operator, t, from LMP of E to LMP of omega, you have a set of assists. The operator is called assisted bounded depth if at any point x, the linear functional that takes f to tf of that x is a bounded depth. And so here I've written out what that means in terms of formulas. Okay? Again, stop me if anything is unclear. I'm going to try to zip through, and I'm going to try to make everything clear. Of course, those goals are confident. Okay. Today, Jx of f denotes the Taylor polynomial of degree m minus 1, not m, of f at x. And that's natural because LMP embeds in c m minus 1 local rather than cm. And so today, script p is going to be the vector space of all m minus first degree polynomials. Okay, so here's today's theorem, which combines several of the theorems from the second talk yesterday. So suppose p is greater than n, e is a finite set with capital N elements in Rn, then there exist lots of things, a set of assists, a list of linear functionals, and a linear extension operator with the following properties. So first of all, t is bounded from LMP of e to LMP of Rn with a norm that depends only on little n and p. And furthermore, t is of omega assisted bounded depth. Furthermore, we can compute the order of magnitude of the norm thanks to the inequalities on this slide. So we take the functionals c sub l, evaluate them at f, raise them to the pth power sum, take the pth root, that's the triple norm of f, and the claim is that the triple norm of f is comparable to the trace norm. Moreover, each of those CL is of omega-assisted bounded depth, and the number of Xs grows only linearly in the size of the set E. So that, I think that's today's theorem. Okay, so today's theorem deals with finite mean, but if you go back and look yesterday at the one and only theorem stated for infinity regarding Sobolev spaces, the only theorem mentioned, I think, was the existence of a linear expansion operator for arbitrary infinity, and that follows from today's theorem about finite mean just by considering arbitrary finite subsets of E and passing to a Baumach limit. So in that way, we get the linear extension operator, but we lose control of what it might look like. So it would be nice to sharpen the discussion to say something about what the T looks like. Okay, the results stated last time amount to saying that today's theorem holds, and furthermore, that the assists omega, the functionals C1 to CL, and the operator T can be computed efficiently. Now, the computation of the omegas, the omega c's and t's, is a long story, and we've had enough long stories, and we're about to hear another one. So I'm just not going to say anything about that, except possibly to make a few remarks at the end if there's time. Okay. All right, so I want to prove today's theorem. I've stated it, and I want to prove it. So here's the introduction. In many ways, the proof for the Sobolev case follows the proof for CM in the case of finite E. In particular, we're going to introduce local interpolation problems. We're going to attach labels to those problems, and the way we do that is based on the size and shape of a relevant convex set sigma. Okay, we will solve local interpolation problems that carry a given label by using a Collarron sigma decomposition to reduce matters to subproblems that carry easier labels, same as in the CM case. Okay. However, there are significant differences between and the earlier proofs for CM, so I'd like to explain a little what they're going to be. For CM, remember, first we computed the sigmas and gammas, and then we used them to produce interpolants. For LMP, there is no simple procedure to compute the sigmas and gammas. At the very end of the story, we will find them, but only at the very end, and in particular, we won't get that far today. And so we have to operate without benefit of computing the sigmas and gammas. Moreover, as far as I know, gammas are useless for this problem, only sigmas. Okay, I'll explain why in a minute. And therefore, to prove today's theorem, we're going to need new ideas. The CM case was based on the gammas, and today we cannot use the gammas. We will use the sigmas an awful lot. Okay, so our proof today is going to look an awful lot like the earlier proof for CM, until all of a sudden the CM methods crash, and then we have to do something completely different, and I'll try to explain what that something is. Okay, so let me define the sigmas and gammas for LM for Sobolev problems, and we'll see why the gammas can't be used. And then we'll forget about gammas, but we'll pay close attention to the sigmas. Okay? So suppose that E is a finite set in Rn, and X is a point of Rn. Now, in the CM case, X was typically a point of E. Today, it's going to be important to take X to be a point not of E. Okay? Sigma of Ex is the set of all jets at X of functions in LMP that have semi-normed most one and that vanish on E. That's very much analogous to the definition of the sigma in the CM case. It's just that we're using the Sobolev semi-norm instead of the CM norm. Okay. Similarly, suppose that we've got a set E, a function F defined on E, a point X in Rn, and a positive number M. Gamma F of X, M is the subset of script P consisting of all jets of functions that agree with F on E and that have LMP semi-norm less than or equal to capital M. And again, that's completely analogous to the CM case, except that we're using the Sobolev norm instead of the CM norm. So, as before, the sigma is a symmetric convex set and the gamma is a possibly empty convex set. Okay. Note, these are the true sigma and gamma. We don't have sigma L or gamma L, as in the CM case. No such luck. Well, what's our plan? We're going to construct an interpolant F by using a clever color on Zeigman decomposition, finding a local interpolant FQ for each of the color on Zeigman cubes, and then patching those local interpolants together. Okay. To determine FQ, first we have to associate a polynomial PQ to the base point XQ that lies in or near Q, and we have to do that for each color on Zeigman cube. If you remember several ordeals ago, back to the CN case, that's what we did there. And so far it all sounds familiar. Alright, so here's a picture. We have lots of color on Zeigman cubes. Each one comes with its own base point, and we want to each color on Zeigman cube, we want to associate it with polynomial P. Alright, how are we going to find them? Well, by analogy with the CN case, we might look for P nu belonging to gamma of X nu. And let's go back to the picture. So for each Q nu separately, we might pick P nu in the gamma corresponding to the base point X nu. Okay? And by definition of the gamma, that means that for each nu, we could find an F nu that satisfies the condition in the green box. Okay? Each individual F nu looks good, but we want to patch them together. Now, when we patch them together, coming back to the picture, we're going to be summing the F nu with a partition of unity, and we would like to control the norm of the derivatives of that. But what happens, for example, if the F that we constructed over here for nu equals 1 is mostly concentrated in Q1, and what happens if the F that was constructed for Q2 is mostly concentrated in Q2, and so on? In that case, when we calculate a SOBLA norm, we are summing the pth powers of the norms of the individual fellows, and that's very bad because each one of them is merely, look at the estimate. Each one of them might consume as much as all the resources. So we're in bad shape. So the point is that the integral of the pth power of the derivatives of our interpolant is a finite resource that must be allocated among the Q nu. Okay? That's because our norms are now defined in terms of integrals rather than soups. So that's what makes Sobolev spaces harder than CM, and that's why we can't use gammas. Okay? So that's a fundamental difference between Sobolev norms and CM norms. Does that make sense? Never mind the gammas, let's return to the proof of the theorem. So now I'm going to prepare to define local interpolation problems. So we've got our finite set E, we've got some point Z in Rn. Again, it doesn't necessarily belong to E anymore. Okay? We're given a real value function on E, and we're given a polynomial. Then I'm going to look at F and P together, and I'm going to define the norm, as on the slide, the norm of FP with respect to E and Z, and it is the nth of the Sobolev semi-norms of all F that that agree with little f on E and whose jet at Z is equal to the given P. So that's the problem we're solving. Not only do we want things that agree with F, but we also want things that agree with P at the point Z. Okay, that's a local interpolation problem. Okay, an extension operator for the pair E, Z is a linear map T sending each such FP to a function capital F. So capital F is T of FP, for which capital F is little f on E, and for which the jet at Z is the given P. That's an extension operator, not just for functions, but for pairs FP. And I'm going to say that this extension operator is C-optimal if it's the LMP norm of TFP is as small as it could possibly be, as on the slide. Okay? So it's a slight extension of the idea of interpolating F, or interpolating F, P, which is what we did in the CM case. Okay. Now, suppose omega is a set of assists, a linear functional or an operator, which is defined not merely on LMP, but on LMP direct sum P, may have omega. assisted bounded depth, and there's an obvious definition of that, so I'm not going to say it just to save time. But there's a the fact that these Cs and Ts might live not just on LMP, but on LMP direct subscript P, still allows us to define natural notions of the omega system bounded depth. Okay. So now, what are local interpolation problems? Well, we're given a cube, we're given a finite subset of the cube, we're given a point of the cube, not necessarily a mean. Here's what we want to find. We want to find a set of assists for E. We want to find a C-optimal linear extension operator acting on LMP of E direct subscript P. Okay? And it should be of omega assisted bounded depth. And also a formula for the norm, so we want linear functionals as on the slide, so that each of those linear functionals is of omega-assisted depth. The number of linear functionals grows only linearly in the number of points of E, and we have the usual formula on the slide, but now in the context of FP. So the norm of FP with respect to E and Z raised to the pth power is the sum of the pth power, is comparable to the sum of the pth powers of the linear functionals evaluated at FP. Okay? So this looks an awful lot like today's theorem, except that it's localized to a cube, and it has a script P in it. Okay? The local interpolation problem, written lit of QEZ, is the problem of producing such omega T and lots of Cs. That's the local interpolation. Okay, so here's a little picture. There's our cube, there's our set E, there's a function, there's a base point Z, there's a polynomial P associated with the base point, and we want a set of assists, a linear extension operator of omega ABD, and, well, the conditions on the slide, and the formula for norm of F. Okay? That's what a linear extension, that's what a LIP is, a local interpolation. So today's theorem follows easily if we can show that every local interpolation problem has a solution. And that sounds familiar for the CI case. Okay. So to solve local interpolation problems, we will attach labels. As in the CI case, a label is a set of all the indices of order less than or equal to little m minus 1. And labels are ordered by some total order relation, as in the CM case. No change. Almost as in the CM case, we attach a given label to a given lip if and only if the sigma associated to B and Z has an A basis, as on the slide. Notice that as in the CM case, delta Q is the side length of Q, and C hat of A is some large constant depending only on the label A and on the function space we're working in. The definition of an A delta basis is slightly changed, okay? So we'll get back to that in a minute. But notice, again, here we're using the true sigma because there aren't any sigma L's. In the CM case, we used sigma L's, which helped us to compute things. Okay, so what's an A delta basis? Well, it's slightly different from the CM case simply because LMP CM scales slightly differently. And so here's the definition. An A delta basis for a symmetric convex set sigma at a point Z is a family of polynomials P alpha in script P indexed by the multi-indices alpha in A, okay, with the following properties. Now the properties are going to look quite familiar. The first property has to do with derivatives of the P alpha where the multi-index that specifies the differentiation also belongs to script A. And that's the same as in the CM case. We have estimates for all the derivatives, not merely those corresponding to multi-indices in script A. All the derivatives of the P alpha satisfy the estimates in the second red box. And again, that's exactly as in the CM case. But the only difference is the third box, what's the relationship between these polynomials and the convex set sigma? And, well, if you multiply them by suitable powers of delta, they belong to a constant multiple of sigma, and those powers are slightly changed. Notice in green the minus n over p. Formally, cm is defined by a soup, so we should think that it corresponds to p equals infinity, and so the n over p disappears. And so the different scaling means that there's this slightly different power that has to be used to define an A basis. Other than that, it's the same notion. Okay. And again, C of A is similar to that. Okay. So now we've defined an A basis. So remember, we attach a label to a lip if and only if the sigma has an A basis, as in the CM case. All right? Now, by induction on A with respect to the order, we're going to prove the main lemma for A, which is that any lip that carries the label A can be solved, just as in the CM case. All right? Now, as in the CM case, every lip carries the label of the empty set, because an A basis of A is the empty set, is an empty collection, so nothing required. So the main lemma for the empty set implies that any lip can be solved, and that in turn implies today's theorem. So what we're going to do is prove this main lemma for A, and we're going to prove it by induction on A. Okay. So, induction on A, the base case. Well, remember, script M is the minimal element of, is the minimal possible label with respect to the order, and it labels the easiest problems. And in this case, if you chase down the definition, it turns out that the only problem that carries the label M is the case in which E is the empty set. And now because we have a P sitting in the problem, it actually makes sense to talk about a lip when E is empty. Okay, so the notion is well defined, but the problem is trivial. We want an interpolant whose gen is P at the given point Z, and which agrees on a function not provided on the empty set. So all we need is that the jet is P, and so we can define T of P to be P, and that's it. Okay. So the base case, A equals M, is completely trivial. Okay. So now the induction step. So let's fix a label other than the base case, and let's assume the induction hypothesis, namely the main lemma holds for A prime, for all A prime less than A, and under that assumption we have to prove the main lemma for A. So that is, we have to solve every lip that carries the label A. Okay? All right, now remember, a subset may or may not be monotonic. Okay? A label is monotonic if the condition on the slide holds, namely, if you take an alpha in A and you add to it a multi-index gamma, just making sure that alpha plus gamma has order less than or equal to m minus 1, so that it might be an A, then it is A. Whoop. Oh dear, there's a misprint. That the bottom line should be alpha plus gamma is an A, not M. Alright, so if A is either monotonic or not, that's the same definition as in the CM case. And as in the CM case, if A is not monotonic, you can easily manufacture a label A prime that precedes A in the order less than by simply adding to the multi-indices alpha in A all the multi-indices gamma of low enough order that would be A plus gamma in M. So one can also prove, as in the CM case, that every lip that carries the label A also carries the label A prime. And therefore, the induction step in our proof of the main lemma for A is trivial for non-monotonic A, because for non-monotonic A, the main lemma for A is exactly the same as the main lemma for A prime, which we're assuming as part of the induction hypothesis. Okay, so from now on, let's assume A is monotonic. Okay, so here's what we've got so far. We fix a monotonic label. Here's the next misprint. A is less than M. Remember, M is the minimal level condition. Say A is not equal to M. Okay. We assume the main lemma for all A prime less than A. We fix a particular lip that carries the label A, and our task is to solve that lip. Okay. Once we do that, our induction on A will be complete. That proves the main lemma. That proves today's theorem, and we can get to the break. a linear extension operator T and a set of functionals such that, first of all, the T agrees with F and with P, as on the slide, with the semi-norm F and LP of Rn as small as possible up to factor C. Furthermore, we have the formula for the norm, for the order of magnitude of the norm, as shown. And these functionals and the operator are of omega assisted bounded depth. And the number of these linear functionals, C1 through CL, grows only linearly in the number of points of E. That's what we've got to do. And we've assumed all this induction hypothesis, and we've got a label A. Okay, that's the setting. Okay. Now, in order to solve it, we're going to make a Kolmogorov-Zipf decomposition of 3 times the given Q0, as in the CN case. Starting with 3Q0, we repeatedly bisect until the following rule tells us to stop. So here's the stopping rule. And it actually, I think, looks quite familiar. It's almost exactly the same as the Kolmogorov-Zipf rule for the CN case, except that here, we don't have any sigma L's to talk about, and so this is the analogous condition. Anyway, it's morally the same, so we stop cutting the Q if either E intersect 3Q contains at most one point, in which case interpolation problems are trivial because you're trying to interpolate only one point, or there is an easier label A prime preceding A in the order so that the localized interpolation problem on the slide localized to 3Q carries a better label than A, and it carries that same better label for all X in 3Q. So that partitions 3Q0 into finitely many Kolmogorov-Zipf cubes. For each Kolmogorov-Zipf cube, we pick a base point in Q not too close to E. Remember before we picked a base point in E not too far from Q. Now we're picking a base point in Q not too close to E. There is one, because otherwise E would be all over Q, and our Kolmogorov-Zipf rule would tell us to bisect Q. Okay. So we can pick a base point, ZQ in Q, not too close to E. Now our plan is to associate to each ZQ a polynomial PQ, and then to define local interpolants that satisfy the conditions on the box, namely on E intersect 3Q, they agree with little f, and at the base point ZQ, they have the jet PQ that we just picked. And we want to do that with FQ control, in particular, the norm of FQ in LMP should be as small as possible into some constant factor. Okay? So that means we're going to solve localized problems associated to E and ZQ. I'm sorry, to Q. Problems localized to the Kolmogorov-Zipf cubes. Okay. All right, once we do that, we have our local interpolants FQ, and then we patch them together with a Whitney partition unity to form a grand interpolant F, which we hope does what we want. So we hope that we can control the LMP norm of F. We hope that it depends on little f of P via a linear operator of assisted bounded depth with respect to some suitable set of assists. And we hope that there's a formula for the LMP norm. That's what we need our F to do. Okay? And so here's a picture. Here's 3Q0, the big Q. We've got a red dot in the lower left-hand corner. Z0 at which some P0 is given. Okay. We've got our green set E. It's finite, but I drew it like a blob. For a typical Q, Kolmogorov-Zipf cube, the dotted slightly larger blue cube is supposed to be 3Q. Inside Q, we have ZQ. We want to find PQ, and once we have found PQ, we will use that PQ as one component of a local interpolation problem. We'll find local interpolants on the dotted blue cubes, and we'll patch them together with the partition unity. Okay, that's the plan. And it all sounds very familiar from CN. I can pause count how many times I've said that.
The reason we combine the ZQ is because when we cut, we wanted a label which wasn't the empty set. So the only way there would be a ZQ is if the carried the label the empty set.
Right, exactly. Yes. And if the label is not strictly less than A.
Sure.
Yes, yes. Wow, okay. A plus. A prime. Okay. All right. So how are we going to find the FQ? Well, for each Calderon-Zygmund Q, by definition of the Calderon-Zygmund rule, either E intersect 3Q contains at most one point, and so finding a suitable FQ is trivial. Or the local interpolation problem on the slide carries a label that precedes A, thanks to our stopping rule. Okay? And in that case, we can find a suitable FQ thanks to the induction hypothesis. We can solve local interpolation problems that carry labels easier than A. And we know that we can control the norm, and we know that it depends on the data via the linear operator of assisted bounded depth, and we know there's a formula for the norm. That all sounds good. So can we use all that to prove all the desired properties of the grand patched together interval depth? Well, maybe. As in the CN case, this idea will work provided that we make a good choice of the PQ. We have to make sure that each PQ depends on the data of the original problem via linear operator of assisted bounded depth, so that in the end, the operators that functions that we pick are like that. But we also have to make sure that the FQ are mutually consistent. And the mutual consistency of the FQ, right, of the PQ, enters because we're going to use the following elementary patching lemma. Okay. In the previous Gaslight lecture, I made the tactical mistake of leaving this bottle over there and it looked so far away. So suppose that we patch together functions fq using the Whitney partition of unity form f. Let zq be in q for each q, and let pq be the jet of fq at the point zq. Okay. Then we get an estimate for the Sobolev norm of f as on the slide. I'll tell you what the notation means in a minute, but notice the first term on the right-hand side has to do with the individual Sobolev norms of the pieces f sub q, of course that should enter. But there's also a piece that represents that the fq had better agree with one another pretty well. And so that gives rise to the second term. So in the second term, this notation q with a two-headed arrow, q prime, just means that q and q prime touch. And as usual, del q is the sign length of q. So there's the patching lemma. So in order to make our program work, we had better pick the PQ in such a way that the second term in the conclusion of the patching lemma is under control. Otherwise, we're out of luck. Okay. So far, everything has looked familiar from the CN case. That is about to stop right now. Because in the CN case, we picked the PQ using the convex sets gamma L. Well, in the Sobolev case, there are no gamma L, there's only gamma F. And we can't use gamma F for reasons that we went into earlier in this lecture. Okay, so we need to do something new. Okay, so I'm going to stop hearing the phrase as in the CN case. Okay, so what is the new thing we need to do? Well, let's look at three examples. Andrea, in our conversation yesterday, I said there are two examples, but I forgot there are three examples. Okay, so here's the first example. We're working in, let's say, the Sobolev space L2P of R2 of the plane. And because P is greater than N, P should be greater than 2. So E is the set of green dots, simply a whole lot of evenly spaced dots on the x1 axis. Our point C0 is a nice safe distance away from those green dots, and our Q0 is, let's say, the unit square. By the way, which label does this problem carry? And the answer is it carries the label with the single multi-index 0, 1, because there is an obvious, the sigma is big in the direction corresponding to the polynomial X2. Right? There is a function that vanishes on E, whose gradient, I mean, whose jet at Z0 is the polynomial X2, x2, and which, yeah, so vanishes on e, and, well, yes, n is enormous, less than 1. Okay, so that's the label. Now, in that example, here's what the color on the Ziegler cubes look like. Okay, so the smallest ones contain only one green dot, and then as you get farther and farther away from the x1 axis, the squares, the color on Ziegler squares grow until, for example, one containing z0 is basically comparable to a logarithmic square. Okay, now, how can we make local interpolants for the smallest cubes? Here's one of the smallest cubes viewed through a microscope. So viewed through a microscope, the green dots are not so far apart. Our cube contains only one of them. There's the dotted 3 cube, and it contains only one of them. But there's enough local information nearby that that the only ambiguity in figuring out what a good interpolant should be is that we don't know what the partial derivative of f in z2 is. I'm sorry, in x2. And we can simply declare that, well, we have this faraway point z0 at which we have assigned a polynomial p0, and we can just borrow the x2 derivative from p0, as on the slide. And so that's what happens at the smallest scale. And so for each q on the smallest scale, we build an interpolant f q like that. Okay? All right. Now let's look at a larger cube. So here's a picture of a larger cube, Q, which lies noticeably away from the green dots. Well, in that case, what we're going to do is just take, we're going to associate some Q sharp to Q, which is on, so Q sharp is on the smallest scale and is roughly as close as possible to Q, okay? We're going to look at the interpolant that we already built for Q sharp. We're going to take its jet at some convenient point, Z sharp of Q sharp, let's say at the green dot. And then we're just going to take FQ to be a polynomial, namely the jet at that point, Z sharp, of the function FQ sharp. Okay? So we're going to take our interpolant on the small square, we're going to find its jet at one convenient point inside the small square, and we're going to use that polynomial as our interpolant at the larger scale, 1q. Okay, there's one special exception. For the color on Ziegler cube that contains the base point z0, we just set fq equal to the given polynomial p0. Okay, so we've now defined fq for all the color on Ziegler cubes. Okay, for all the color on Ziegler cubes. And you can check that if you then patch these guys together with a Whitney partition of unity, it works. It has all the desired properties. And so we're done with example one. Okay, is it clear, more or less? No one objects, okay? All right, let's look at example two. So again, we're working in L2P of the plane. Again, P is greater than two, but this time E is a set of closely spaced dots on the X1 axis together with another closely spaced set of dots on the X2 axis, and our base point Z0 is safely away from the action in the lower left-hand corner, and associated to Z0 is P0. Unlike the previous problem, in this case, the label is the empty set, because there aren't any very convenient functions that vanish on these dots and have L2P norm less than 1. Some, but it's, yes, trust me. Okay. Well, all right. In that case, what does the color on Zygmunt? What do the color on Zygmunt cubes look like? Well, there are small. There's the smallest one, Q1, where we stop because there's only one dot. There are somewhat bigger ones, Q2 and Q3, where even though there are many dots, we stop because the Q2, as we've seen, carries a label. Strictly less than the empty set. And similarly, Q3 carries another label strictly less than the empty set. There we stop at cubes like Q4, which are simply away from the action and contain no green dots. And there's a special exception. There's the single cube Q5 that contains the base point. So in this second example, there are lots of possibilities. Now, at the smallest length scale, there is enough information to figure out the interpolant. Now, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. At the smallest length scale, Q1 Q1 contains only one dot. But if I dilate Q1 by some convenient factor like 100, this is the picture, and it contains enough dots that there's no significant ambiguity. You can figure out the full gradient, and you can, in any plausible way, you can make the interpolant that nature wants you to make on the Q1. All right. Now let's look at larger length scales. Well, they're cubes like Q2 and Q3. Remember, they're larger. They contain many dots. Now, both both local interpolation problems on Q2 and on Q3 have significant ambiguity if you view Q2 and Q3 in isolation. But we won't view them in isolation. We can import information from this smallest cube, Q1. We found an interpolant, and at some convenient point, Z sharp on Q1, we can take the jet. And for the case of Q3, where the X1 derivative is ambiguous, we can declare that it's simply going to agree with the X1 derivative from our polynomial P sharp that came from the smallest square. And similarly, for things like Q2, the ambiguity is in the X2 derivative, and so we import that from the smallest square. Okay, and so here are the formulas. So once we've resolved their significant ambiguity, as just explained, we can produce Q2 and Q3 by the same method as in example 1. Okay. For a cube such as Q4, away from the action, things are even simpler. We can set the corresponding interpolant for Q4 simply to be the polynomial P sharp that arose from the little guy. Same P sharp as above. Okay? And there's a special exception, the square Q5 that contained the base point. And we just set our interpolant to be the given polynomial P0 that was part of the data for the local interpolation. Okay? And that works. And so one can check. There are obviously a lot of cases, so it's no fun, but one can just check that F, obtained by piecing together those interpolants, has all the desired properties. So we're done with example 2. All right, here is example 3. And so it looks sort of like a letter H. There are lots of dots on the x1 axis, and there are lots of dots on two separate vertical lines. And safely away from the action is z0, the red dot, and an associated polynomial p0. And again, the label A here is the empty set, because this doesn't look like the zero set of anything. Okay, here are the Kalman Zeeman cubes. I've colored some of them orange and some of them black. And between the orange cubes and the black cubes is a boundary, which I've indicated with a fuzzy blue line. Okay? And the story is that to produce all the local interpolants FQ, we simply treat all the orange cubes as in example 2, and we treat all the black cubes as in example 2. For the orange cubes, there's an obvious dot in the middle that plays the role of the dot for the smallest cube, Q1. And for the black cubes, there's a different point that plays that role. And so for all the orange cubes, you forget about the black cubes and just do your thing. And similarly, to treat the black cubes, you forget about the orange cubes and act as an example too. Okay. And by the way, orange and black are the same. So notice, as in example 2, information flows outward from the smallest orange cube to all the orange cubes and from the smallest black cube to all the black cubes. Okay, so we're done with example 3. So the moral of the story is that Kalman-Zeeman cubes, Q sharp, at the smallest length scales carry the crucial information needed to define mutually consistent polynomials PQ for all the Kalman-Zeeman cubes, Q. That's the moral of the three examples. Okay, so what we're going to do is independently treat each such Q sharp and find polynomials PQ sharp associated to them. And for each Q at a larger scale, we will find a nearby Q sharp, and we will simply declare that PQ is equal to PQ sharp for that associated. Yes.
So in the boundary, for example, three in the boundary, you just do with Whitney or partition?
Yes. So each cube is either orange or black.
Yeah.
And so this boundary is in between the orange cubes and black cubes. So I guess the short answer to the question is yes. Okay. Yes, so we just move with Whitney. And of course, there may be some awful price to pay if things behave very differently in the black world versus the orange world. But that's life, that's the best we can do. Okay, so having learned our lessons from the above three examples, let's return to the general case and recall what's going on. And so here's the situation, okay? There's the picture, right? I think the picture is basically clear. Q is a column on Zygmund Q. We found our base point ZQ, and we want to find a polynomial PQ, and we want a clever way to pick it. Okay, so let's pick out the color on Zygmund cubes at the smallest length scale. So a color on Zygmund cube is called a keystone cube if every color on Zygmund cube that meets 100 times Q sharp is at least as big as Q sharp. That's a reasonable way of saying that the Q sharp is at the smallest length scale. Okay, so that's a keystone cube. And so here's a picture. Let's see which artist produced this picture. It's Charlie. So in this example, the red square is keystone because if you dilate it by a factor of 100, all the other squares are at least as big. But the green square, which should be a square anyway, the green square is not keystone because if you dilate it by a factor of 100, there are some smaller squares. Okay. Now, how do we associate a polynomial to each cube, to each color on Zygmund cube cube? So that good stuff on the slide happens. The plan is that first we associate to each color on Zygmund cube a nearby keystone cube. Then we assign to each keystone cube a polynomial, treating all the keystone cubes independently of one another. For each color on Zygmund cube, we define the polynomial associated to it simply to be the same as the polynomial associated to the keystone cube, which in turn we associated to Q. That's the plan. Okay? But we make a special exception for the color on Zygmund cube containing the base point. To that cube, we simply assign the polynomial to P0. And that's a pain in the neck, but simply ignore that from now on. We have to do it, but I don't want to keep saying it. All right, so how do we carry out the plan? So first of all, how do we find the nearby keystone cube? Well, here's one way to do it. Let Q be color on Zygmund Q. Now, if Q is already keystone, our problem is very easy. We said Q sharp equal to Q. Suppose Q is not keystone. Then I claim that there is a path, as shown on the slide, from Q to a smaller Q, Q tilde. And Q will be joined to Q tilde by a finite sequence of cubes that I'm calling Q1, Q2, etc. And each one of these Qi is touching the next one in the chain. Okay, so this chain contains at most a bounded number, at most C cubes, and the one at the end, the ones along the way may be bigger than the cube that we started with, but the one at the end is definitely smaller, so it's at most half as big, because these are all diagonal cubes. Okay. So I claim that's possible, and then I'm going to call that cube tilde a junior partner of Q. Here's one way to find a junior partner. Start with Q and dilate it about its center, but not by a fixed amount. Let the dotted green cube grow. Okay? Let it grow until we find that it touches, until the dotted green cube touches a Q tilde, which is smaller than Q. Okay. Now, we will dilate by at most a factor of 100, because if we got to a factor of 100 without finding a Q tilde, then Q already would have been keystone, and we wouldn't be in this mess. So, inside the dotted green cube, we have our junior partner Q tilde, which is strictly smaller than Q, and the geometry of the cubes that intersect the dotted green cube is very simple because they're all bigger than or equal to Q, so they're most a bounded number of them. And therefore, we can find a path from q to q tilde, passing through not many q's. I hope that's a plausible thing. Okay? So q is either keystone or it has a junior partner. And if there's a junior partner, then either that junior partner is keystone or it has a junior partner. And if we reach the second, you know, the junior partner of the junior partner, either it is keystone or it in turn has a junior partner, and so on and so on and so on. We are going to continue on in this way until we reach a keystone Q, and the process has to stop eventually because there are only finitely many colorons in the Qs. We have no control over how many there are, but there are only finitely many. So each of these non-keystone Qs is joined to its junior partner by a suitable path that is not very long, and if you concatenate all those paths, then you arrive at a path from the original Q to a keystone Q, in such a way that each of the intermediate cubes is a Coleron Sigma cube. And although these cubes do not necessarily get shorter, they get shorter eventually in the sense of the estimate in the box. So that's one way to produce these paths to keystone cubes. Now, okay, we then define K of Q to be Q sharp, the one that I just explained. That's one way to associate to each Coleron Sigma cube the nearby keystone. So we might declare victory over step one. But in fact, we have to be much more careful. So we have to also make sure, I think as Ignacio was implicitly worried about, we have to control the border disputes. So a border dispute is a pair of adjacent Coleron Sigma cubes to which we associate different keystone cubes. Let me call that a border dispute. And the number of order disputes should run only linearly in the number of points of E. And so we have to be much more careful, but it is possible to associate keystone cubes to Coleron Sigma cubes in such a way that we control the order disputes. Okay? And so let's simply believe it. And so we've carried out step one of the plan. We have assigned to each Coleron Sigma keystone cube. Okay. So I'm sorry to talk about 10 minutes over, and I will skip a lot of slides also. Okay. All right. Step two, let Q sharp be a keystone cube. We want to look for a polynomial P, Q sharp, to assign to Q sharp. Now, our Q sharp, our piece of Q sharp, is supposed to arise from the data by applying a linear map of ABD. Okay? And for any, well, all right, so and we should make a good choice of the P Q sharp, and it's not at all clear how to do that. So what we're going to do is we're going to take any P Q sharp and let it try out for the role, okay? And we're going to evaluate how well it does. Once we do that, once we know how to do that, we will then pick P Q sharp to do as well as possible. Because we are in the business of picking a PQ sharp, at this stage we only have to make guesses, later we have to prove stuff. All right. So, for any given P sharp, let's try setting PQ sharp equal to P sharp and see how well it does. Okay, so once we do that, we'll then take our actual PQ sharp to be the P sharp that performs best or at least. Okay, so in order to guess how well P sharp performs in its role of a candidate, sharp, we examine what happens on the dilated Q sharp by a factor of 100. Now, Q sharp is keystone cube, so 100 Q sharp looks very simple. Namely, if you look at the Coleron Sigma cubes that meet 100 Q sharp, because Q sharp is keystone, there are only about a number of such cubes, and they're all about the same size. Okay, they're all bigger than Q sharp, but they can't be much bigger than Q sharp. So, so the geometry is simple. Okay. Now, in each Q, in each of those Q mu, we picked out a base point, and it's not too close to E. Just for ease of notation, instead of Z sub Q mu, the base point, I'm going to write Z sub mu. And so here's the picture. Okay. There's our keystone Q sharp. There are the Q mu and Q mu and so on, the Coleron Sigma cubes that meet 100 Q sharp, and in each of them is a red dot, that's the base point. And remember, we picked the base point to be pretty far away from E, and so those are the green circles, and inside the green circles, there are no points of E. Okay, So that's the picture. Now, all right, so we are happy with our picture of 100 Q sharp. Now let's see how well P sharp behaves. Well, suppose we try to set PQ sharp equals P sharp. We then look for a function that agrees with F on E intersect 100 Q sharp and has this jet at, let's say, at the point ZQ sharp equal to the given Q sharp. And we ask, how small can we take that Sobolev norm? And so our candidate is going to perform well if that Sobolev norm is small. How are we going to compute that Sobolev norm? We're going to guess. Okay. So given a P-sharp, we want to find an F-sharp that that interpolates using that P-sharp as an input. We want to guess the Sobolev norm on the square 100 P-sharp. And then once we've found that guess, we have a number, and we're trying to make that number small, and we pick P-sharp in order to do so. That's the plan. Okay. So how do we do that? How do we find the F-sharp, first of all? Well, we can solve each of the localized problems associated to the cubes Q nu, okay, thanks to the induction hypothesis. Remember, the main lemma holds for using labels. So we can solve those. And so life is good, provided we can associate a polynomial P nu to each of those Z nu. Remember, we haven't yet assigned polynomials. We are only in the process of testing a candidate for the role of the polynomial associated to the keystone. However, because the geometry is so simple, if we can associate a polynomial to each of the keystone cubes, to each of the Calderon-Zeigler cubes that meet 100 Q sharp, then we can find nearby optimal extensions. We can then patch them together with a Whitney partition of unity, and we can find our best F sharp, and we can try to compute its norm. How do we guess those P nu? Well, because the geometry is so simple, we might as well just set all the P nu equal to P sharp, and you don't really lose from that. So we've guessed which polynomial to assign to one of our, to Q sharp. Let's guess that all the other jets are simply equal to P sharp. Okay? And then you can go ahead and produce local interpolants, and the local interpolants produce then a patch together interpolate F sharp, and we like our candidate P sharp if that norm is small. Okay? How do we guess that norm? Well, we use the patching lemma. So here's the patching lemma. Okay. Where these jets P mu and P nu are the jets of the local interpolants F mu and F nu. Mu double arrow to nu means that the cubes touch. However, we have set all of the P mu equal to P sharp. So the consistency term, the term involving the difference of P mu to P nu, is simply zero. And so that term goes away, and the patching lemma gives this. Okay, that's all rigorous. But now let's guess that, in fact, the left-hand side and the right-hand side are comparable. They will be unless there's some miraculous cancellation. So let's guess that. Okay, so that means we can guess the order of magnitude of F sharp, of the norm of F sharp. And, for each Q nu, we've solved the local induction hypothesis, and so in particular, it gives a formula for the norm. And if you plug those into the patching lemma, you get a guess for a formula for the norm of F sharp. So here's a guess. Okay. So this is formula smiley face. So formula smiley face is the sum of the pth powers of a whole lot of functions. And we want to pick our polynomial P sharp to make that as small as possible. Okay. Now we know at least how to run the contest. Here is a thing that we can compute. We sincerely hope that it is a reasonable guess for the norm of the thing we're trying to produce. And we will make it as small as possible up to a factor C. That's the plan. Okay. So now we know how to evaluate candidates. We can pick the winner and declare it to be PQ sharp. Let's see how that goes. So remember, we're given data F and P0. For a given keystone Q sharp, we want to pick Q sharp from among the candidates. But there's a significant thing. I guess I'm wrong. We'll one more time, I'm going to say, as in the CM case, we have to pick our candidates that are consistent with P0 in the sense of the green box. Some of the derivatives of P sharp minus P0 are identical to 0. That happened before. That's going to create consistency by removing unwanted freedom of maneuver. So let's call such a P sharp coherent with P0. For all P sharp that are coherent with P0, we're going to make the one that makes our conjecture formula yield us the smallest possible result up to a factor C, and that will be our choice. Okay. Well, so we're trying to minimize this. Wait a minute. We would like to make P sharp depend linearly on the data, and there's a crucial point that we can pick our winner to depend linearly on the data thanks to the following simple result, which I may or may not have time to state. Okay, so, yes. Suppose we have an awful lot of linear functionals on Rn, direct sum Rd. Think of D as fixed, but K and N are enormous. Okay, given a vector V in Rn, we want to find a vector W that almost minimizes the sum of the pth powers of the linear functionals. Okay. The dilemma is that there is a linear map from Rn to Rd, so that if I tell you the V, you can take the W to be that linear map associated to plot to the V, and that particular choice of the W equals TV, will minimize the sum of the pth powers up to a constant that depends only on D. That's very lucky. That's actually trivial. It looks too good to be true, but it is true and it's trivial. It follows by induction on D. The case D equals 1 follows from Holder's inequality, and the induction step follows from the case D equals 1. Please just trust me. No time to explain. So we've picked an essentially optimal P sharp coherent with P0, and it depends linearly. Okay. Proof of the one. No time to explain. Okay. So now we finally have our PQ sharp, and indeed it depends linearly on the data. However, it's probably not ABD. Why should it be? And so the solution is simply to add new assists. And so for each keystone cube, we add the assists, simply we take all the derivatives of the PQ sharp, and we declare that they are the new assists. And so then, trivially, the map that associates to the original data, the FPQ sharp is then AVD with respect to the new assists. Of course, we have to prove that the new assists still form a family of assists. That was the defining condition, so there's something to prove, but it is true. Okay, so we've now finally succeeded in assigning polynomials to the keystone cubes. On to step three. Given any Kalman single cube, remember we've produced a keystone cube nearby, as in step one. And to that, we have associated a polynomial PQ sharp, as in step two. So step three consists simply of defining a PQ to be equal to PQ sharp, where Q sharp is the associated keystone cube. So much for step three. Okay, so now we have succeeded in assigning polynomials PQ to each of the Kalman single cubes PQ. Okay, so where do we stand? Well, we've fixed a monotonic. We've assumed the induction hypothesis. We want to prove the main lemma by solving a local interpolation problem. If you fix such a local interpolation problem, we want to solve it. And here I reminded you what it's supposed to do. And finally, we're supposed to produce the formula for the norm of our interpolate. Okay. Well, that's what we have to do. What have we done? We've made a Kalman single decomposition. In each cube, we've fixed a base point. By carrying out steps 1, 2, and 3, we have assigned a polynomial to each such cube. And our Kalman single stopping rule guarantees that each of these local interpolation problems, highly local, localized to the little Kalman single cubes, can be solved. So from each of these, we obtain a local interpolate FQ that does what we want. And and moreover, for each of these, we have a conjecture formula for its norm. And then using the Whitney partition of unity, we patch them together to make F, the grand interpolate. This F is automatically going to agree with the data, and it's automatically linear ABD. But we need to do more. We need to produce an actual rigorous formula for the norm, not just a guess. And we need to show that our F that comes from this procedure is approximately optimal. Namely, if there is any competing function, F tilde, that agrees with the data, then the Sobolev norm of F is less than or equal to a constant times the norm of F tilde, so that our choice is approximately optimal. Once we've done that, we are done. Okay, producing the conjectured formula for the norm, there are two pieces. First, we produce our conjectured formula for the norm. We don't prove that it is the order of magnitude of the norm. We only prove that it's greater than or equal to the norm of the F that we found. That's not hard, because the only non-rigorous thing we did was to assume that the left-hand side and the right-hand side of the patching lemma were of the same order of magnitude. If you drop that assumption, you get one side of the matter. Okay, the other thing we have to do is to prove that any competitor has a norm that's bounded below by our conjectured formula for the norm of the F that we produce. That is a very long story, and I have 1 minute in which to. I barely have time to say it. I'm not going to tell it to you. So, okay, I'm not going to tell it to you. Let's just believe it. Once we know these two things, then taking the competitor F tilde to be equal to F, we now have a two-sided inequality comparing its Sobolev norm to the conjectured formula. Once we know that, we return to the lower bound in step two, and it now tells us that our F is almost optimal. And so we are done. This finally concludes our discussion of the proof of today's theorem. And if I have one more minute, I will say a little bit about computing things. So remember that the proof that we've just zipped through uses the true sigma. There are no sigma L or gamma L as in the CDM case. Therefore, to compute anything, we really need new ideas. Because the stuff we define is based on the stuff we are trying to compute. And that is an even longer story. Okay, let's just declare victory. And so we're done with Sobolev spaces, at least for today. But for the future, what about the case of the less than equal to n? Thank you. This as well as I do, at least as well as I do, because I don't remember it, so you cannot remember it less than I do.
I think many cubes are closer to one cluster than the complement of that cluster.
Thank you.
And so that you can bound sort of the border disputes where something is seeing two different clusters or galaxies in your interstellar analogy.
Thank you, yes. That's the answer. Thank you.
So you said that the norm was a finite resource that had to be used carefully.
Yes.
But I'm not sure that we necessarily, or at least I got lost, how that happens.
You didn't get lost. I didn't show you. It's a long story. What to say? Okay. Suppose that you are just looking at a dilated Keystone cube by a factor of 100. Well, you cannot do better. Oh, okay, wait. Here's the thing. Okay, here's maybe what I might say. Suppose you take any competitor. Now, you could try to modify the competitor without increasing its soap level very much. You know that the competitor agrees with the given jet P0 at the base point. You could show that the competitor could be modified so that at each Calderon Zeeman cube, all of the derivatives coming from the label of the jet at some convenient point in that Calderon Zeeman cube are exactly what they should be if this polynomial is the given polynomial. That's called coherent with P0. So you can assume you can modify. You can then modify further by saying, so each Calderon Zeeman cube is connected to its keystone cube. And you can further modify the competitor so that its jet, as you continue along this path to the keystone cube, that all of those polynomials are the same. Those are applications of solar inequalities. If they're different, well, they can't be too much different because you pay a price in terms of the solar limit. Okay, so once that happens, then you ask, all right, so consider only competitors that do all that stuff. Now, estimate their norms using the patching lemma. Given those, you can then see. You can, all right, consider all of the ingredients in the conjecture formula for the norm of the guy who produced. Each term can be dominated by the pf power of the Sobolev norm of the competitor on something, some square or the union of two squares or something. And that's again just by Sobolev. Okay. And then once you know that, you can sum up over all the terms and check that the squares don't overlap significantly. And therefore, the sum of all of the terms in the conjecture formula will be less than or equal to the pth power of the Sobolev norm of the competitor times a constant. So the norm of anything is greater than or equal to the conjecture formula. On the other hand, using the patching lemma, one can and our understanding of what happens on 100 Q sharp for keystone cubes, one can show that the F that we picked, it has norm less than or equal to the thing. Okay, and therefore we have allocated our resources wisely.
Okay, let's thank Charlie again. Okay, so just a few announcements. So for 95% of the people here who are requesting some form of reimbursement aside from the hotel, I need your ID or a scan of your ID. So there are two ways to handle this. You can either email this to me, or I have an app on my phone, and if you'd like to just come up to me right now, I'll snap a picture of your ID. So either of those two things. Give that a thought. The second thing is about people who are leaving today to the airport. The travel time is about 23 minutes right now, and that's going to persist until about 3 p.m., and then between 3 and 4, it shoots up a lot. There's a lot of traffic between 3 and 4. So give yourself an extra 20 minutes to get to the airport. By the way, my phone now thinks that I'm leaving on 20 different flights today because I have all of you've all sent me your flight information. So if any of your flights are delayed, I'll be suffering along with you, if that's any consolation. Okay, so we're going to start the second lecture maybe a little bit late because this one ended a little bit late. So let's start at 10:45. Sounds okay? Okay? All right.
Okay. form for electronic function.
I'll bring this later. I'll bring this. You'll be here for the afternoon lecture, yeah?
Unfortunately, not me.
Okay. I'll get this to you by the end of Charlie's second lecture.
Oh, it's zoomed in the left.
Oh, no, I can set it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was wondering, I sent you an email of mine. I didn't know if you already had
it. I got it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
we're good. And I have yours as well.
Yeah, okay. I just wanted to say thanks for organizing the conference. It's been really nice.
Oh, yeah,
yeah.
Cool.
I'm Darren.
I'm sorry that we didn't have the chance to talk yet, but I did get to talk with your collaborator, Scott, yesterday.
Yeah,
so that was
yeah.
really nice and to find out what you guys are doing. And it's really cool that you guys are able to come because I think that you guys are really close to...
Yeah, I think it's given us lots of new ideas that maybe some things make sense and maybe sort of money instead of...
Yeah.
Kinds of
yeah, for sure. Definitely we'll include you in the future conferences in the email list.
Yeah, that sounds great.
We're going to be in UC Davis, I think, next year.
Okay, it's like a yearly thing?
Yeah, last 12 years.
Cool. So what are you kind of working on now? Are you doing public stuff?
No, I'm still working back in the classical CM stuff and working on sort of in the weeds, getting improvements to some of the constants C in these theorems. So the constants K are pretty well known to be under control, but the constants C are pretty bad.
Okay. And if you want to compute anything, then you really need some.
Right. So even in small examples, if like you're in dimension 2, 3, 4, and M is 2, 3, 4, then the constants are double, triple exponential in their dependency.
Okay.
So it blows up pretty quickly, even for relatively simple problems. But we're able to, I think, conjecture that we can remove the C, replace C by log C, so to reduce one tower.
Okay.
So that means that maybe a few more problems would be within reach.
Yeah.
The constants are still going to, there's still the coercive dimensionality, but you'd hope that some things would be pretty nice at the upload dimension.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Oh, it's nice to meet you.
Yeah, it was nice to meet you too. Thank you.
Exactly.
So you do have my ID. I sent you a picture of
it. Yes. Thank you.
I don't need to send it to you.
Yeah, you have everything. I would very positive.
I try to stay consistent.
Then thank you so much for coming.
It's my pleasure. You know, I hear a lot. So
you're your first, what year are you now? Your fourth year, right?
Yeah, I'm finishing my fourth year, so I'm starting my fifth.
Who do you work with?
I'm working with Earl Hamel. That's my
friend. He must have arrived after I left. I'm not familiar with the name.
And then Morales James.
Not familiar with that name. He must have also arrived after I left.
Yeah, so
the last tower,
I think
the last hire I did was Hunley Long. Maybe I told you that.
Yeah,
Hunley Long was hired just right before I left. I don't know if he's still there.
He's still there, so
Yeah. And I left, let's see, I guess maybe the usual suspects are still around. His closest to retirement, maybe Fred Richmond was closest to retirement.
Yeah, you're retired. You're retired actually. Yeah, you're
still I thought Hoffman was close to retirement. I hear
he's still pushing.
He's still pushing.
Yeah.
Who else did I think would possibly retire?
Schmidmeier is still there.
Of course. He's young, right? He is still young.
Yeah. For me, he's not young. He's like
60.
Yeah, I think so. Who else is still there? Oh, Matt DeVries.
Is Mike Myers retired?
No, he's still there.
Yeah. Well, Mike Myers and I were
he's
very
close. Active, too. You know, yeah, like he just finished. Yeah, he just graduated about. He had three students, I think all three of them. One just graduated this spring.
Right. I don't know what I've seen. My clerks and I were really close, though. He was sort of a lot of my
students.
He was on my book. And I took calculus with Fred Richman, and I took combinatorics with Schmidmeier. Not just Fred Richman. I took calculus 3 with Milman. Is Milman still around?
Yeah, he's gone before even we came. Probably when you got there, probably Steiner was
there. He must still be active, but he must have just moved to a different university.
I don't know.
It took Richard Brewer passed away in 2008. Said that was my commuted algebra teacher. Yeah, he passed away in the day of cancer in 2005 or something. It's like, I need to come back. I was last there for UARM's birthday conference 3 years ago.
Did you come back and give a talk?
Yes, definitely. I mean, my family doesn't live in Boca anymore, so.
Oh, they're out of state now?
Yeah, they live in Northeast. So I have, I need to come back to visit UARM, though.
Okay. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. I'm still here. I'll be here, like, probably until evening session.
So after evening session. Yeah, we're probably going to end things a little bit earlier. We'll only do one of the poker conversations.
Okay.
Is this good enough, or do you want the passport?
Yeah, this is great. This is really easy. Just do this, and then we just hit that, and then it automatically generates the box. And that
wow.
And then it just, one button, and then it uploads to Google Drive, where my receptionist has access to it. Okay. So these documents will eventually be deleted out of the folders, but...
I assume, but that's fine. So, in the end, Jacob couldn't come, I guess.
Jacob?
Yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. He had, doing well?
He's fine. We're just, like, totally underestimated how much work it would be for my wife and my mother, who's visiting, to help. But totally underestimated how much work it was going to be to do all this stuff. And so they were just, everyone was exhausted at the end of yesterday. So they didn't make it out. But everyone's healthy. I don't know if I can show you the photos.
No.
But I'll just show you what the family looks like. The family looks now.
She wants to go back to the an earlier situation in which she was happier.
Oh shoot, I have to charge this.
Oh.